a big part of it in the military was every place that a commander goes is going to be better. Is he going to the right places? And I would argue that the CEO is the same way.
Welcome to the Business of Doing Business. I'm your host, Dwayne Kerrigan. With 35 years in business and close to 30 ventures across 12 industries, I've seen a lot. Amid the celebrity allure of entrepreneurship, many exceptional entrepreneurs remain shadowed. Here, I team up with these hidden talents to unveil their challenges and successes. Dive in with me to unearth entrepreneurial gems, learn from our experiences, and get educated. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Business of Doing Business podcast with General Craig Nixon. Just as a reminder, this is a two-part series. This is the second part. And I don't want to go through his list of accomplishments. You'll hear it in part one because it's just endless. If you haven't heard this, you got to go back to last week where we released the first part of our conversation and start with that. Come back to see us this week. It's unbelievable. It's a don't miss. It's not very often you can gather this kind of information from someone who's been so successful in the military and then gone on to be uber successful in the business arena as well, post his military career. So please tune in. This is an unbelievable conversation. Thank you for listening. Appreciate you. I was really curious earlier about how often do you see the CEO of an organization that's making too many of the decisions? I mean, I see it quite a bit. Now, we're different size businesses for sure, but in these, you know, mid-size businesses, it astonishes me how often I hear some of my friends who are like, you get involved in that? Like, it's shocking. And I probably like to think that I don't, but I probably do. It's always easier to judge other people.
There's two sides to it. One is the CEOs themselves. So a good friend of mine gave me this philosophy. He said, only do those things that only you can do. And then he added a caveat, and that might not be the things that you want to do, which is the most important side of that. I'll equate it to back to the military. I mean, everybody wants to be the guy going in the door and clearing the room. And we used to do a lot of room clearing exercises in shooting houses. And I would find a lot of senior officers over there observing that training. There was some level of risk you could get somebody hurt in there. But in reality, they had no impact on that. As a non-commissioned officer's skill set, they were better at it than we were. And, oh, by the way, the Rangers listened to them more than us as it related to those kind of skills. Adjacent to that would be platoon evaluations where you had a force-on-force blank fire, and you're evaluating platoon leader's abilities to make decisions when he's got an opposing force. That's where the company commander should be, because that's the impact. So I used to talk to commanders about, here's two scenarios, where would you put yourself? A big part of it in the military was every place that a commander goes is going to be better. Is he going to the right places? And I would argue that the CEO is the same way. So on one level, it's the CEO understanding in the organization where, you know, what's the only things that they can do and where are they making an impact? And then being disciplined. And then there's another side to it, which is you get, you know, the action officers suck you into it. Because the problem with providing context and delegating down and giving autonomy is you're now forcing people to make decisions at the level they should make them, which, oh, by the way, they're accountable for. So there's a portion of the organization and any organization that doesn't want to be in that. They want to be able to provide you the information so that you can make the decision. And at the end of the day, they're not really accountable.
They're not accountable, right?
So what I talk to people about is you can delegate authority, and you can and should delegate authority, but ultimately you're always responsible for it. The commander's responsible for everything his organization does or doesn't do. CEO, same way. People understanding that you always own the responsibility. You're just delegating the authority because that's the best way to do it. You got to underwrite some mistakes along the way.
I've done this myself for sure. I'd like to think that I'm not doing it near as much, like a small percentage. Sometimes I find I get sucked into the things that I'm really good at, or I get a hero biscuit for if I solve it. It's like I get to put my Superman shirt on and like, look at me, you know, I'm so smart. Do you have any comment around that or any thought process about A, the cadence, the discipline of that? And then even to your point earlier about people coming to you to look to make a decision and therefore they're no longer accountable, how you push those people away in an effective manner to go and make their decision that they need to make rather than trying to get you involved. And we call it, don't put your monkey on my desk.
Two different things. I think the first thing is, how are you holding yourself accountable? And so it kind of gets back to that four C's discussion. How, or more correctly, who is pulsing you when you're doing stuff that you shouldn't be doing? I mean, whatever you're doing, you're going to make it better, but time and energy can be better served someplace else. I'll tell a quick story. Years and years ago, I was at JSOC, and I had probably been there too long, and I'd seen everything multiple times. And this was at the early days of the internet and email. And I sent out an email that said the top 10 reasons that JSOC needs a director of common sense, which immediately went viral. Within hours, I was standing up in front of the commanding general's desk who gave me the "I'm disappointed in your speech." But everything that I didn't embellish anything. Everything that I said was true, but I shouldn't have done it. So I made a deal with myself. I said, from now on, every organization that I'm involved in will have somebody explicitly tasked with being the director of common sense, which is easy in the military because you always have command sergeants major. And I was always the director of common sense. And in writing, I would specify, he is the director of common sense. He has the ability to throw the yellow flag on anybody in this organization, to include myself. You know, if we're not living the creed, living the culture, doing something stupid, he could cross any of those boundaries. Well, I did the same thing in business. I actually went and hired one of my old command sergeant majors and brought him in because he's a brilliant guy and do assessments and all that. But he also could keep me honest and had no problem closing the door and saying, "Boss, you can't do that," or "Here's the impact of what you're doing." So, I mean, your board does it to a different degree and your mentors do it, but creating that network that's going to kind of keep you honest as you go through it. So that's one piece. I think the other piece, I think you've got to establish things that make it hard for, you know, the action officers to feed you their work. Some of it was explicit. I would put it in my flop. I mean, I talked directly about, you know, I don't want to be sucked into being an action officer. I've got other stuff to do. And then, but a lot of it was in performance counseling. I think you've got to be indirect in the way you approach that. The higher you go up, generally, the more positive you have to be. Because the reality is you don't see everybody all the time. If the only time they see you, you know, you're chewing their rear end, they're going to find a reason not to be around the next time you come through. So I think you've got to work by, with, and through other people that interact with you more and know you better to adjust some of that discussion. And I was fortunate to have experienced that from the other end and got to see some great leaders. They would leave and I think that I was in great shape. And then, you know, 2 hours later, the next boss down was like, "You screwed this up.
We got to talk."
Yeah. But the boss didn't say anything. Oh yeah, he did. Just not to you.
Yeah. Just not to you, man.
I think there's an art to it.
I love it.
It's kind of the, we've talked before, it's a little bit of how you focus in an organization. Like in the military structure, at the platoon level, you were all internal, 40 people. Company command level, mostly internal, a little bit up and out. Battalion command was the big break point. So successful battalion commanders, about 800 people, were either 40% internal and 60% external, or 60-40. Somewhere in that window is usually where I saw. At the regimental command, most of my energy was external. It was all the other things that I needed to shape or mitigate before they hit the organization, which meant the time I spent internal to the organization was precious. I had to get as much value out of everything that I did internal to the organization because I had so much energy, like your friend, going out and visiting customers, or in my case, coordinating with other commanders or all of that. So you have to get really good at how you're doing things internally.
You brought a couple things up there that, and I'll just voice them and we'll get back to them before I re-forget them. But one was, how do you make those decisions? Like, how do you really look at your organization and go, okay, hey, here's my time as a COO, and this is how I need to really maximize the value that I put into the different areas that I need to be? That'd be one question. And then the second question was earlier about training. You had talked about the training that happens inside, you know, the military, and I'd love to just go back later to talk about that, but I just voice that outside so that I know what I want to get back to.
On the first part, to me, it goes back to what's the vision, what's the strategy? And then the next subset of that is, if that's the strategy, who are the people and or organizations, internal and external, that are going to enable what I'm trying to do? And this gets to the kind of rule of 150. So I believe if we define relationship as somebody that knows what you're trying to do and is actively supporting what you're trying to do, we are limited in those number of relationships that we can have. And I would say 150 to 250 is kind of what the academics say. So that's the old rule 150 kind of mindset. The reality is the networks are different. So the network I had in the military was different than the network that I needed to accomplish what I was trying to do at McChrystal Group. It was different than the network I needed at Academy or Constellus. So understanding what the networks are and then developing an engagement strategy around that. So how frequently do I need to interact with those individuals so that they know what I'm trying to do and actively are trying to assist me to do it or giving me information that I need to do it? And that then drives a big part of your battle rhythm or your cadence. And what it's also going to do is force you to group things together. So if I had the right people together in the forums, then I could gain efficiency internally, which allowed me space Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday to engage externally or travel, or in the military, we would do the troop visits and all that kind of stuff. In my last tour in Iraq, I was responsible for three provinces. One was Diyala, Salahuddin, and the other one was Kirkuk, which is about the size of, a little bit smaller than Texas. So it's the northeast size. So in that year, I spent 1,000 hours in helicopter. I would spend 2 days in Salahuddin, 3 days in Diyala, 2 days in Kirkuk. I had a command post at each one of those locations. So I basically would fly in, see a unit, go to my command post, interact with the other U.S. forces, Iraqi leadership. But I had to know who was the network that was important for me to touch, and what was the frequency that I was going to do that, and then really drive to do it. And the same thing applies in business.
Yeah. Here's my question about that, I guess in business, but how did you manage yourself? Did you have multiple assistants, chief of staffs? What did it look like? How would the mechanism look like around you in order to support the effort and for you to be knowing all the information so that it was flowing to you so that you walked in and could only do what only you could do?
I'll talk about how I did it then, because it does change every place on in your environment, but you got to think through it. So I had the larger division headquarters was at Salahuddin. So I plugged into the division headquarters whenever I was there. So we had a big operating fusion cell and all that kind of stuff there. When I went to Diyala, I had I had office, all my comms were set up, all that kind of stuff. I flew with a pretty small, I had an aide, a communicator, and a couple of PSD guys, and that was pretty much it. That's what I traveled with. So I had a small group that I traveled with, but I plugged into a running cell there. And then there was a brigade there, so I could tap into what they were doing. I had comms all the time. I had the ability to plug in at each one of the locations. And then I had two or three guys that kind of made sure everything went well and I didn't get shot in the process going between the sites. So I think you have to think through it, but you've got to be able to travel and you got to be able to plug in wherever you're at, which is much easier now than it was then. ability to communicate so much better now.
How would you manage yourself, like with your team and Constellus? Like, what did that look like in regards to aides, assistants, etc.?
Very similar for a variety of reasons. I'm not a big personal staff guy. I had a small, when I would do my circuits, I had a very small travel team. One or two people would go with me. We had our primary headquarters was in Washington, D.C., and I had a big training facility down in North Carolina, and I had an office in Dubai, and I had a big office in Afghanistan, and I had an office in Baghdad. So, I mean, I had plenty of places that I could plug in along the way, and then in all the locations, we had connectivity already because they were tied into the system. So it was just making sure that we had connectivity en route as we went through. But to your point, it's something that you have to think about, because for me, it was all about how do I get the most bang for the buck on this? And as much as I traveled, I still was only getting to see individual sites maybe once every 9 months. Because we were so distributed, you just can't get out to the site. So the time that you spent with us, so we would do all hands wherever we went. I had a number of ways that I would try and connect, you know, levels down and get to the rumor control that we talked about at each one of the sites. So, I mean, it's got to be a big part of what you think about. It's like going to a big conference. I'm involved with the RSA conference. Now you go to the conference, there's 40,000 people there. If you don't have a plan, you're just wasting a week.
Yeah, no, it's great. That's unbelievable. So rule of 150, you had mentioned that, and I just wanted to clarify. So is that, could you clarify the exact rule of 150 and how you implement it?
150 people, you can know all of them. I mean, you can, you know, if you're in charge of 150 people, you know them, you know their names, you know their families, you know their backstories, you have some level of personal relationship. So you can lead and will lead differently at that level. But when you get to 800 people, you don't know all of them anymore. So now you are leading by, with, and through other people. You are leading more indirectly as you go through. The fundamental leadership doesn't change, but you have to change the way you lead as you scale up. So I think understanding that, and then, you know, how do you apply it? How do you lead differently as you scale is really important.
So that circles back to actually the, you know, one of the questions I had earlier, which was around your training. So you had talked about, you know, the immense amount of training that you did in the military. When you went to Constellus, would you guys use some outside firms to do that type of training for these kinds of things, like people who are managing up to 150, people who are managing 150 to 300, 400, and onward to 800?
Yeah, we did a combination. One of the things that I was very interested in doing, because one of the reasons I went to Constellus was, or Academy, was the fact that it was a lot of former veterans. That's who we're employing, particularly in the private security contractor field. And it was a field that wasn't really defined. I mean, it really took off kind of in the early days of Iraq or Afghanistan. So one of the things that we did there that I was very focused on was what's the career path for a private security contractor? How do you grow up through that system? How do you, you know, what's the training required? How do you move to the next level? Some of it's formalized program manager training, that kind of stuff. So we developed a leader plan. We had a outside the leadership development where they could go in and do self-study, or they were part of that. I believe that the forums, as much as anything, were the way that I could have impacted that. So the way that we interacted on the forums, the way I interacted kind of two levels down, the way we interacted with cross-functional teams that were brought in to briefs, that was, I view, my role in that. So create the environment, develop the system, give them the resources, but then personally to provide context, not just in the way we do business, but the way to think about leading, the way to think about, you know, interacting at that level. I think that's a big responsibility for senior leaders in an organization.
I'm kind of like, I actually just looked at the clock. We've been like at this for an hour and 45 minutes. It feels like it's been 10, man. This is fantastic information. And I did have a burning question earlier about, you know, your four C's. You talked about competent, confidence, complacent, and catastrophe. Like, where do you think the ideal range is to float in between those four C's?
It depends on what level you're at. So I need a whiteboard, but I love whiteboards. I use a kind of risk decision model. So I'm a big models guy, if you haven't noticed by now. But so if you think at the bottom of the pyramid, which is the vast majority of any organization, they react to an issue. The next level up, which is smaller, they can identify the problem. So bottom level reacts to the problem. Next level identifies the problem. Next level solves the problem. And a very small number of people can prevent the problem. And so you get to the pyramid through training, technology, and experience. So how do you get to the top of the pyramid? You got experience, you've been trained, and you're leveraging technology. So if you think about that model and now apply it to the four C's, what you really want to do is you want to take the people in the bottom, who are the people that the catastrophe has occurred and they're reacting to it. You want to move as many of those people to the right side of catastrophe so they can at least identify the catastrophe before it occurred. You want to get the people in the next group that can identify the problem to solve the problem. You want to move them up the chain to identify complacency before it heads towards catastrophe. The people at the top are the ones that can pulse the system between confidence and complacency. Those are the preventers. So as you think about it, how do I train the masses to understand what are the mechanisms for them to throw the yellow, you know, red flag when we're approaching catastrophe? How do I train the next level to identify complacency and solve it before we move into that? And then how do I get the right senior leaders, CEO included, to pulse the system to understand when we're moving from confidence to complacency and pulse the system then? So it's the combination of those two models in the way I approach it.
Right. Yep. That makes total sense.
It works much better with the whiteboard then.
Yeah, well, that'll be interview two. I'll send you a digital whiteboard and we'll get it all on screen. I did really want to talk, because you did talk a little bit about like peer networks and mentors, and it kind of finishes that circle at the beginning that we talked about from the three things: bigger than yourself, level up, level down, and mentoring. Just wondering if we could spend some time on that. You've been so generous with your time, Craig. I'm ultimately so grateful. But peer mentoring is an interesting concept, and I think sometimes doesn't happen as often as it could, especially in those mid-sized organizations. And then just mentoring, your thought process on mentoring, your advice to it, some strategies around it, both receiving it, I think sometimes giving it too. I'm a big believer in mentorship. I don't think there's ever been a time in my life that I haven't had a mentor since I was, you know, kind of 18. But I also think that receiving mentorship is one thing. Providing mentorship is also another thing. I think providing mentorship made me a better mentoree, actually. And so I just love to hear what you have to say on that and how you've implemented it in your organizations, and give maybe the listeners a little idea of where they can implement those things.
I will state up front, I'm probably better at being mentored than mentoring. I've received unbelievable help from mentors over the years, and I've always kind of had one, whether I knew it or not. I think it's hugely important. I have many of the same mentors now, but I have a whole new host of mentors. Not host, I have a couple of mentors now since I've transitioned into the business world. For me, it's always the best mentors were always kind of one or two levels up, not way up, but had walked the same path as you, were not in necessarily direct competition with you, and were interested in kind of enabling your success. And I'm speaking generally now. I think there's tremendous value from that, because they have lessons learned that you don't have to get the same scars necessarily as you go through it. It's got to be a personal relationship that runs both ways. I don't think you can force mentorship in either direction. And I think it's founded first and foremost on, do you connect at a human level? Do you have a shared value system around that? As an example, I said I followed Stan McChrystal in six jobs, but we only worked together once out of those six. So when I first joined the Rangers, he was also in the Rangers. He was a rank higher than I was. I didn't work for him. We were both staff officers at the time. And from then until 2003, over that course of time, I never worked directly with him for the rest of the time. But I probably ate at his house 50 times over that course of time. And we communicated a lot. And then as it would happen on 2003, he took over as the JSOC commander and I took over as the regimental commander. So I worked directly for him during that period. So he was always two or three ranks ahead of me and had done the same jobs at different times. And we had different views on some things because the conditions had changed, but it was always great insight. And it was also helped keep me accountable as we went through. And frankly, had a network that then could help influence as you did that. We also had, you know, the formal performance counseling system where you would engage with whoever, you know, your boss two levels up were. So you got organizational mentoring institutionally in the Army. But Stan, there's Frank Kearney, a couple other guys were the guys, and they're all kind of in that same mode where the guys that I would look to going up. And then as I transitioned into the commercial space, I've got a couple of mentors that were clients of mine when I was a consultant. And when I left to go take over Academy, the conditions for me to take over Academy were that I didn't want to hurt McChrystal Group. Stan McChrystal had to be okay with it because my friendship was more important than the job. And then I had two major clients out in Silicon Valley, and they needed to be okay with me leaving. And it was interesting because I learned something on commercial space. So I went out, flew out and talked to them, and they said, why wouldn't you take the job? How can we help you? And have been mentors. They were mentors then, but have been mentors ever since. So I think that's one aspect. And then there is a peer network aspect to it. I think you have a small group of people when you have really hard problems that are kind of value-based problems that you can reach out to and get advice and do that. There's a larger group of people that may be, you know, your left and right commanders or running similar businesses that you can reach out to on other things. That I think you need to have both networks, and you need to be able to leverage both networks and provide input to both networks.
I'm curious, as you were talking, like one of the things that really popped in my brain there was, what made Stan McChrystal such a great mentor? What were the three or four or whatever components that he possessed or how he approached it that just you found so much value in?
A couple things. I think one, and hopefully I share some of it, he is intellectually curious. Although he was mentoring, he was as interested in my view on a variety of things. We had same experiences, but different, quite honestly, because we were there at different times. And at least in the early days, I had spent more time in combat. I mean, he ultimately spent a tremendous amount of time in combat at senior rank. So he was intellectually curious on your views on it. And he's intellectually curious on a lot of things. At one point, we were in the early days of when they had the iPod, we would all share our books back and forth on the iPod. That was the level of entertainment that we were at the time. But as importantly, I think you could tell he honestly cared about you as an individual and the organization. So there was I used to tell my young platoon leaders I tried to talk to all the new platoon leaders when they came into the regiment, and it was one of the things was, you need to care more about your platoon than yourself. And that's the hardest of the three, you know, give 100%, have great integrity, and care more about your soldiers than yourself. And Stan had that, and it, you know, you could feel that. And then on a personal level, I mean, we just had a lot of common interests, and we continue to have. We still try and meet once a month and drink a beer and run the full gamut from politics to national security to business to, and it's always really interesting discussions.
I'd love to carry your bag for that meeting.
I think it's the old line, when you feel better about yourself when you're around somebody. And Stan has a unique way of making you feel better about yourself when you're around them. And it's not Machiavellian, it's sincere.
I've heard that. I mean, I've heard unbelievable things about Stan.
I've tried to emulate it. I'm not as good. I try.
Can't have looks and everything, right? Like, I mean,
I'm a work in progress.
Okay, so I'm curious, what do you think makes a great, like, to get you know, the attention of somebody like Stan McChrystal? Obviously, you guys had a friendship, but it started probably before that. What do you think it requires to be a really good mentoree? You know, there are some people out there that, you know, are looking for mentorship, probably have had mentorship and couldn't keep it. I mean, I've got my own thoughts on it, but I'm curious on what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think you have to have some basic level of intellectual capacity. I mean, so there's that aspect to it, although that's setting a pretty low bar with me. I'll just tell you what I look at. Do they have the drive, or are they aspiring to be better as a leader, better as a person, better as a manager? So do they have the drive? Do they have the willingness? And those are two different things. Are they self-aware and humble enough to actually receive input? And are they willing to make the commitment? So yeah, I said, yeah, I ate dinner with Stan 50 times. But a lot of that was because I made sure that I made myself available, you know, whenever, you know, so there was a little bit of, I'm in town, let's get together. So, you know, it works both ways. And I think even more so in the commercial world than in the military world, because I can go a long period of time because of kind of what we've done. We can go long periods of time without seeing each other and reconnect pretty completely. But for mentors that don't have that shared experiences, you know, the frequency that you've got to engage is much, much more. And you've got to build it into your schedule, you know, every 6 weeks or so, where you checking in. So I think a combination of those. I'd be interested in yours. We probably have a better articulated.
I think those are spot on. I would say the desire to take action and move forward would be the one I would add to it. Is I love investing time with people who want to learn, who are curious, who are, you know, willing and committed to the process, but also it's, you have to be able to take some action to move forward and to grow and stretch yourself. So whether that's be vulnerable, whatever bucket you want to put that in, but I think that would be like kind of the one that I would add for me anyways. I'm curious, you know, as you're talking about, this is going to be my last question because we're into 2 hours here. We're going to split this into two episodes because it's been fantastic. I was curious, how's your leadership evolved over, I guess I'll use, I don't want to say decades, I'll use maybe the phrase, the phases of your life, coming in at 22 into the military, and as you've flown through your career with, I mean, let's face it, I'm sure you've had your downsides, but if you look at the line of success, it looks like the recent stock market in the last kind of 12 months, right? It's like, I know you're a super humble man and I honor that, but you've just, there's no equivocating about your results. So I'm curious if you could just kind of run through what that looked like for you as you were growing, and especially in those early days when you're uncertain and the future wasn't clear and the path might have been a little bit more foggy than it could be today.
Yeah, I do it a couple different ways. I was in the early stages, I was very competitive, very driven that whatever organization I was in was going to be the best organization and put the, you know, the time, energy, and effort into that. In the Rangers, we used to have to do a psychological assessment every time you would come in. So I'd have the same psychs that would do their psych assessment on me each time. And they did it over the years. So they were always tracking, did my personality change, any of that. Their feedback to me was that my leadership style was controlled aggression. Which, to be honest, is probably pretty accurate for the early days of my leadership. What's changed over the years is I think I've become, and one, it has to, but it's like, obviously, you've got to, as you scale up, you've got to be more positive, it's more indirect, it's more enabling. The organizations that you're leading are fundamentally different. So when you're leading a small group of infantrymen or a small group of rangers, there is an, you know, there is an expectation that, one, you're going to lead from the front, and two, ultimately, you're going to take them into combat. They have to have trust and confidence that you're going to be technically competent, tactically competent, and care more about them than yourselves when you get into it. That was what my foundation of leadership was and went through. I think I've matured over the years and I guess mellowed out, but I'm still very driven. It's just I lead differently now than I led from the beginning. And I've become a student of leadership. So I spend a lot of time studying it, talking to other people that are doing it, getting different feels on it. Despite the stock market analogy, I've had my 2008s along the way. I've had crisis personally. I've had crisis organizationally. I've been through all of that. And frankly, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. I mean, I would like to think I'm pretty resilient over that. And I like to think that I've built resilient organizations along the way as well. So, but to me, it's all a journey. I mean, it's like everything else. Just enjoy the path. And then hopefully you can directly or indirectly impact people along the way. Probably the thing I'm most excited about is when I look in the Army and see guys that I worked with or worked for me that have far exceeded anything that I did in the Army, that are much more successful from a rank standpoint or positional standpoint. I get a lot of value out of that. I would like to think I was one portion of helping them succeed. In some cases, in some very small ways, and others, you know, more directly.
I'm sure there's no question about that. I mean, the time that you've spent here with us will ripple effect out to our listeners as well. That's not the beginning of a goodbye. I do have like the controlled aggression when you said it. Obviously, I burst out laughing because I mean, I feel like I should go buy a bumper sticker and put that on my car. Some people might say mine would, you know, has tended towards uncontrolled aggression. But I just was curious just to pick your brain about the transition to being like more patient. Two kind of small questions in there, which would be, was there any guilt or forgiveness required for you, self-forgiveness for you to move to the next level from controlled aggression to like what happened to make that transition? You kind of said, well, I've mellowed as I've gotten older. And I think that has happened to me too. Was there a shift, I guess, is probably a better way to ask it, that really helped that transition begin?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I think having my kids was an important step in that for me. I had, you know, three girls, which was also, I mean, I largely grew up in a male dominated, the infantry at that time was all men and rangers were all men. My wife has worked on me continuously. So I think that was part of it, you know, feedback from peer network and mentors and trying to incorporate the things that they, you know, they were helping and just role modeling other people as they went. I know people that were not particularly, they were good, but they weren't great at the tactical level, and they became much better. They self-actualized much later in their careers. And conversely, I watched people that were really good at the tactical level that failed miserably when they scaled. And so part of it was a self-evaluation of, okay, I've been successful doing this, but, you know, is it successful as I move forward? So some of it was self-evaluation. Some of it was from close network of friends and peers. Some of it was kind of getting deeper into leadership and studying the personal growth aspects of it, which I probably did much later than I should have in my career. I think it was a combination of all those.
What would be a couple of your top favorite books when it comes to leadership?
Well, my all-time favorite book is a book called Once an Eagle by Antoine Meyer.
Once an Eagle?
Really interesting book. It traces two officers from World War I all the way to the Vietnam War. And one officer is kind of what everybody wants to be. Sam Damon is this war hero, enlisted guy, just hard worker. And the other guy is kind of perfumed prince that, you know, is a staff guy and he's got some character flaws. And it tracks these two leaders across their careers. And what's interesting about it is the guy that you don't like actually ends up higher ranked and all that kind of stuff at the end. But it shows that you can be successful multiple ways. And in reality, you need both traits from both of those guys. But it's just a really, really good book. You know, so that's foundation. That's what I give to most kids that are, well, I say kids, guys that are going in the military. If I can give them one book, it's that book. I've read a lot of biographies because I think it's really interesting to get kind of the biography stuff. I was big into Zig Ziglar, if you remember Zig Ziglar.
Oh, God, I used to love Zig Ziglar, man. That was the best. I was just actually, literally 2 or 3 days ago, I was Googling some of his videos.
Early on in my career, he's pretty foundational. I liked the way, because he approached time as well. Time was very important to him and how he characterized time. Good, Great is a good book. I've gotten into Stoicism, so I do a lot of the, I read a lot of this. I was just reading How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, which is about Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I'm across the board on a lot of different. What I encourage people is to read a lot and read a wide variety, but because you'll get, if you get stuck on a handful of books, it gets you, it's almost worse than not reading at some point, because you get kind of narrowly focused on one thing. So my rule, which I stole from my command sergeant major, was after you've read 4 kind of good books, then you get 1 brain candy book. So that's the thriller, science fiction, or whatever. The latest book I just read was Erasure. It's the movie is American Fiction. Really amazing book.
That's awesome. Craig, I mean, I can't thank you enough for being here. We've banged out 2 hours and 15 minutes here, and this could be the longest podcast that we've done. So
I don't know if that's good or not, Dwayne.
I know it's awesome. Like, I mean, it is awesome. I think you lend to, you know, you're so down to earth. You've just had, like you said, you've had your 2008s, but you've just navigated your way through waters that people can't really sometimes get their head wrapped around. And, you know, your commitment to yourself, your commitment to your leadership, your commitment to your family. And to me, I would, you know, I'd say, like, first and foremost, thank you for your service. I was going to say not to the country, but to the world. It really, you're a giant among men. So I appreciate you being here.
Well, thanks. You're very kind. I appreciate the invite. I was humbled watching some of the other podcasts. So
they're going to be humbled watching you, man. Appreciate you being here. Thanks for listening. I appreciate you being with us. If you found value in the show and know a friend or a coworker who could benefit from the conversation, please share the link via text or on social media. Remember, each share creates a ripple effect of knowledge and inspiration. We'll see you next week.
The views, information, or opinions expressed by guests during the Business of Doing Business podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Dwayne Kerrigan and his affiliates. Dwayne Kerrigan or the Business of Doing Business podcast is not responsible for and does not verify the accuracy of any of the information contained in the podcast series. The primary purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. Listeners are advised to consult with a qualified professional or specialist before making any decisions based on the content of this podcast.